Welcome to Program Notes for your North Carolina Symphony, an exclusive production of the Triangle Radio Reading Service. I'm George Douglas. I'll be reading the program notes for all of the Classical Music Series concerts by the North Carolina Symphony for the remainder of the 2019 season. The program notes I'm reading today are for the performance by the North Carolina Symphony at 7:30 p.m. Thursday, January 10th, at Memorial Hall, UNC Chapel Hill, and 8 p.m. on Friday and Saturday, January 11th and 12th, at Maymandy Concert Hall, Duke Energy Center for the Performing Arts in Raleigh. This concert will be conducted by guest conductor Karina Kanalakis. The program on this performance will include the following. The North Carolina Symphony will come on the stage to perform the Symphony No. 40 in G minor by Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. Then following the intermission, the symphony will perform the Symphony No. 10 in E minor, Opus 93 by Dmitri Shostakovich. Now I'll begin our reading of the symphony notes. First, I have some information for you about our guest conductor. Karina Kanalakis is the newly appointed chief conductor of the Netherlands Radio Philharmonic Orchestra in Amsterdam, beginning in the 2019-2020 season. Winner of the 2016 Sir George Schulte Conducting Award. She first made headlines in 2014 when she filled in last minute for Jaap van Zweden with the Dallas Symphony Orchestra, where she served for two seasons as assistant conductor, leading more than 60 performances with the orchestra. Highlights of the current season include the Nobel Prize concert with the Royal Stockholm Philharmonic Orchestra and debut engagements with the London Philharmonic Orchestra, Oslo Philharmonic, and Deutsche Symphony Orchestra Berlin, in addition to debuts in North America with Orchestra Symphonique de Montreal and the St. Louis Symphony Orchestra. She led the Los Angeles Philharmonic in September at the Hollywood Bowl and has an Australian tour conducting the symphony orchestras of Melbourne, Perth, Adelaide, and Tasmania. Her 2017-18 season began at the BBC Proms in London with the BBC Symphony Orchestra, where she returned this past summer and featured debuts including the Orchestra de Paris, National Orchestra of Spain, and Seattle Symphony. Highlights of the 2016-17 season included the world premiere of David Lang's opera The Loser at the Brooklyn Academy of Music and Verdi's Requiem at the Zurich Opera. Previous appearances with the North Carolina Symphony have included concerts in 2017 featuring Mozart's Sinfonia Concertante and his Piano Concerto No. 24, performed by pianist Long Long. Already known as a violinist, Kanalakis was encouraged to pursue conducting by Sir Simon Rattle, while she was playing regularly in the Berlin Philharmonic as a member of their Orchestra Academy. In addition to appearing as soloist with various North American orchestras, she played regularly in the Chicago Symphony Orchestra and appeared on several occasions as guest concertmaster of the Bergen Philharmonic in Norway. Karina Kanalakis was born and raised in New York City. She holds a bachelor's degree in violin from the Curtis Institute of Music and a master's degree in orchestral conducting from the Juilliard School. She speaks French, German, and Italian. Now, let's take a look at the program for this concert series. The program begins with the Symphony No. 40 in G minor, Kerschel Listing 550 by Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. Mozart was born January 27, 1756 in Salzburg, and he died December 5, 1791 in Vienna. This work was composed in 1788, and the first performance is actually unknown. Here is the overview. At no time was the separation between Mozart's personal life and his transcendent music more apparent than in the summer of 1788, when at the age of 32, he had only 3 years to live. His wife was ill, and his own health was beginning to fail. His six-month-old daughter died in July. Don Giovanni had received a disappointing reception at its Viennese premiere in May. He had small prospect of participating in any important concerts, and he was so indebted he would not answer a knock on the door for fear of finding a creditor there. Yet amid all these difficulties, he produced in less than 2 months the three crowning jewels of his orchestral output, the symphonies number 39, 40, and 41. The G minor alone of the last three symphonies may reflect the composer's distressed emotional state at the time. It is among those great works of Mozart that look forward to the passionately charged music of the 19th century while epitomizing the structural elegance of the waning classical era. It may be, wrote Eric Blom, that the G minor symphony is the work in which classicism and romanticism meet, and where once and for all we see a perfect equilibrium between them, neither outweighing the other by the tiniest fraction. It is in this respect, at least, the perfect musical work. Now here's what to listen for. The symphony's pervading mood of tragic restlessness is established immediately at the outset by a simple arpeggiated figure in the violas, above which the violins play the agitated main theme. This melody is repeated with added woodwind chords to lead through a stormy transition to the second theme. After a moment of silence, a contrasting lyrical melody is shared by strings and winds. The respite from the movement's driving energy provided by the dulcet second theme is brief, however, and tension soon mounts again. The wondrous development section gives prominence to the fragmented main theme. The recapitulation returns the earlier themes in heightened settings. The Andante in sonata form uses rich chromatic harmonies and melodic half-steps to create a mood of brooding intensity and portentous asceticism. Much of the movement, especially the development, makes use of the repeated notes of the opening theme and the quick fluttering figures of the second subject. Because of its somber minor key harmonies, powerful irregular phrasing, and dense texture, the minuet was judged by Arturo Toscanini to be one of the most darkly tragic pieces ever written. The character of the minuet is emphasized by its contrast with the central trio, the only untroubled portion of the entire work. The finale opens with a rocket theme that revives the insistent rhythmic energy of the first movement. The gentler second theme, with a full share of piquant chromatic inflections, shows the hurtling motion only briefly. The development section exhibits a contrapuntal ingenuity that few late 18th century composers could match in technique and none surpass in musicianship. A short but eloquent silence marks the beginning of the recapitulation, which maintains the symphony's tragic mood to the close. The evaluation that the French musicologist F.J. Fétis wrote of Mozart's Symphony No. 40 remains as valid today as when it appeared in 1828, and he wrote, "Although Mozart has not used formidable orchestral forces in his G minor symphony, none of the sweeping and massive effects one meets in a symphony of Beethoven, the invention which flames in this work, the accents of passion and energy that pervade, and the melancholy color that dominates it, result in one of the most beautiful manifestations of the human spirit." This work was written for flute, two oboes, two clarinets, two bassoons, two horns, and strings. Following the intermission, the North Carolina Symphony returns to the stage to perform the Symphony No. 10 in E minor, Opus 93 by Dmitri Shostakovich. Shostakovich was born September 25, 1906, in St. Petersburg, and he died August 9, 1975, in Moscow. The composition date is unclear, but the first performance of this work was December 17, 1953, in Leningrad. Yevgeny Mravinsky was the conductor. Now, here is the overview. The resilience of Dmitri Shostakovich was astounding. Twice during his life, he was the subject of the most scathing denunciations Soviet officialdom could muster, and he not only endured both, but found in them a spark to renew his creativity. The first attack in 1936 condemned him for writing muddle instead of music, and stemmed from his admittedly modernistic opera, Lady Macbeth of Mezensk. The other censure came after the Second World War in 1948, and it was part of a general purge of formalistic music by Soviet authorities. Through Andrei Zadanov, head of the Soviet Composers Union and the official mouthpiece for the government, it was made known that any experimental or modern or abstract or difficult music was no longer acceptable for consumption by the Russian peoples. Only simplistic music glorifying the state, the land, and the people would be performed. In other words, symphonies, operas, chamber music, any forms involving too much mental or emotional stimulation were out. Movie music, folk song settings, and patriotic cantatas were in. Shostakovich saw the iron figure of Joseph Stalin behind both condemnations. After the 1936 debacle, Shostakovich responded with his Fifth Symphony and kept composing through the war years, even becoming a world figure, representing the courage of the Russian people with the lightning success of his Seventh Symphony, Leningrad, in 1942. The 1948 censure was, however, almost more than Shostakovich could bear. He determined that he would go along with the party and withhold all of his substantial works until the time when they would be given a fair hearing, when Stalin was dead. About the only music Shostakovich made public between 1948 and 1953 was that for films, most of which had to do with episodes in Soviet history, the fall of Berlin, the memorable year 1919, and some jingoistic vocal works, The Sun Shines Over Our Motherland. With the death of Stalin on March 5, 1953, coincidentally Prokofiev died on the same day, Shostakovich and all Russia felt an oppressive burden lift. The thaw came gradually, but there did return to Soviet life a more amenable attitude that allowed significant compositions again to be produced and performed. Drawing on some sketches dating back as far as 1946, Shostakovich set to work almost immediately on a large, bold symphony, a composition that was to prove the greatest he had written in the form to that time, the Symphony No. 10. It is impossible to know how long Shostakovich had been preparing ideas for the Tenth Symphony. The actual composition of the score in summer 1953 took very little time. The composer wrote almost constantly from early morning until late in the day, taking only brief breaks for meals. It may well be that Stalin's death allowed the dam to burst that had been holding back the ideas he was storing since his Ninth Symphony appeared 8 years earlier, the longest gap between any two of his symphonies. The cohesion and integrity speak for a composition that Shostakovich had formulated carefully in his head before committing it to paper, and it seems that the work may well contain musical images that were the result both of the painful years after the 1948 denunciations and the tempered joy at the release from Stalin's ferocious grip. Robert Layton wrote of the important place this symphony holds in Shostakovich's output, and I quote, "Shostakovich was still in his 30s when he wrote the Ninth Symphony, and the view that he had not wholly lived up to the promise of the first symphony was prevalent. Certainly none of his symphonies was up to this time is absolutely flawless, if judged by the Olympian standards of the great symphonists, though there is no doubt that they offer ample evidence of symphonic genius. The Tenth Symphony changed this. The Tenth Symphony is among the greatest works of its type written during the 20th century. It can be favorably compared not only with the music of Sibelius, Prokofiev, and Vaughan Williams, but also, even more impressively, with that of Brahms and Beethoven. Besides the technical mastery the symphony displays, it, like all of Shostakovich's works in this form, also seems to bear some profound underlying message, some implicit struggle between philosophical forces. When the symphony was new, Shostakovich would give no hint as to the meaning of the work. At a conference of Soviet composers in 1954, he stated, "Authors like to say of themselves, 'I tried,' 'I wanted to,' etc. But I think I'll refrain from any such remarks. It would be much more interesting for me to know what the listener thinks and to hear his remarks. One thing I will say, in this composition, I wanted to portray human emotions and passions." Asked sometime later if he would provide a written program, he laughed and said, "No, let them listen and guess for themselves." In his purported memoirs, Testimony, published after his death, Shostakovich was more specific. "I couldn't write an apotheosis to Stalin. I simply couldn't," he admitted. "I knew what I was in for when I wrote the Ninth, i.e. the 1948 denunciation. But I did depict Stalin in music in my next symphony, the Tenth. I wrote it right after Stalin's death, and no one has yet guessed what the symphony is about. It's about Stalin and the Stalin years. The second part, the scherzo, is a musical portrait of Stalin, roughly speaking. Of course, there are many things in it, but that is the basis. He vouchsafed for more than that. He vouchsafed no more than that, I should say. Knowing what we do about Shostakovich's years of struggle under Stalin and the composer's feeling of release at the dictator's death, it is not hard to fill in what he left unspoken. Because this symphony is ample testimony to his philosophy of music as a communicative art. I find it incredible that an artist should wish to shut himself away from the people. I always try to make myself as widely understood as possible, and if I don't succeed, I consider it my own fault. The Tenth Symphony succeeds magnificently. Now here's what to listen for. The first movement grows through a grand arch form whose central portions carry its greatest emotional intensity. The music is built from three themes, each of which undergoes a certain amount of development upon its initial presentation. The first is a darkly brooding melody that rises from the depths of the low strings immediately at the beginning. As this sinuous theme unwinds in the cellos and basses, the other string instruments enter to provide a surrounding halo of sound. The second theme appears in the clarinet, the first entry by the winds in the movement. The use of tone colors in this symphony, both to provide the sonorous material of the work and to orally define its structure, is masterly. The ensuing treatment of this theme generates the movement's first climax before this section is rounded out by the reappearance of the solo clarinet. The third theme emerges in the breathy, low register of the solo flute as a sort of diabolical waltz. These three elements, low string, clarinet, and flute melodies, provide the material for the rest of the movement. Their integration and manipulation give the impression, even on first hearing, of a work of grand sweep and unimpeachable integrity, an impression that is deepened with familiarity. It is probably the greatest symphonic movement that Shostakovich ever wrote. The menacing second movement purportedly a musical portrait of Stalin, is, in the words of Ray Blocker, a whirling fireball of a movement filled with malevolent fury. Its thunderous tread, a thread, leaves the little doubt of Shostakovich's feeling about the murderous Stalin. Formally, it is cast in ternary form, A-B-A, though the propulsive turbulence of the music leaves little room for subtle structural demarcations. The shortest section of the symphony, it is the perfect foil for the deep ruminations of the preceding movement. Indeed, after the quiet close of the first movement, its beginning seems to virtually explode into the listener's consciousness. The opening gesture of the third movement, three rising notes, is related in shape to the themes of the first two movements and provides a strong link in the overall unity of the Tenth Symphony. As a tag to this first theme, Shostakovich included his musical signature, DSCH, the notes D, E-flat, C, and B. The note D represents his first initial. In German transliteration, the composer's name begins SCH. S in German notation equals E-flat, C is C, and H equals B natural. The movement's center section is dominated by an unchanging horn call that resembles the awesome riddle of existence posed by the solo trumpet in Ives' The Unanswered Question. The opening section returns in a heightened presentation. The movement closes with Shostakovich's musical signature, played haltingly by flute and piccolo, hanging in the air. The very last movement begins with an extended introduction in slow tempo, a perfect psychological buffer between the unsettled nature of the third movement and the exuberance of the finale proper. The finale is both festive and thoughtful, while recalling thematic material from earlier movements to serve as a summary of the entire work. Concerning the ending of the symphony, the British writer on music, Hugh Ottaway, wrote, "The impact is affirmative, but provisional, anti-pessimistic rather than optimistic." Shostakovich left the final interpretation of the Tenth Symphony up to each listener. It is no doubt heroic, filled with struggle and a deep awareness of life's pains. But it is also uplifting in its dedication to the human spirit and the continuity of life against the greatest obstacles. Ray Blocker, in his book on the composer's symphonies, wrote, "Here is the heart of Shostakovich. In this work, he opens his soul to the world, revealing its tragedy and profundity, but also its resilience and strength." The instrumentation for this symphony number 10 is as follows: two piccolos, two flutes, three oboes, English horn, three clarinets, E-flat clarinet, three bassoons, contrabassoon, four horns, three trumpets, three trombones, tuba, timpani, percussion, and strings. These symphony notes were written and copyrighted in 2018 by Dr. Richard E. Rota. You have been listening to Program Notes for your North Carolina Symphony, an exclusive production of the Triangle Radio Reading Service. I'll be reading all of the program notes from the classical music series of the North Carolina Symphony for the remainder of the 2019 season. This program is available on demand as a podcast on the day before each concert series and will remain available for the rest of the concert season. I'm George Douglas. Thank you so much for joining me today. We sincerely hope that listening to Symphony Notes will enhance your enjoyment of your North Carolina Symphony. Goodbye until next time.